Yeah, so I'm Neil. So I'm one of the cosmology faculty here at Perimeter. I'm filling in for Kendrick today and tomorrow because he's doing important things out west. So he asked me to, you know, to describe, or he asked me just to introduce to you guys the first parts of the thermal history of the universe. So this topic, of course, is just incredibly vast, and so in these few days, there won't be time to cover everything. And so instead, I'll just try and give you guys like a few of the like important, like essential highlights. Just bear in mind that this is an incredibly vast and important area in cosmology, which touches on almost everything. And so I apologize for skipping like half of the exciting stuff. So for those of you who are following Daniel Bauman's lecture notes, what I'll be talking about is mostly covered in chapter 3 of his lecture notes. And for those of you who have seen Scott Odelson's book, what I'll be doing is taken from chapters 2, 3, and 4 of his book. Okay, but again, skipping lots of stuff. Okay, so first I thought that that it might be useful just to put this topic in context before we start doing any actual calculations. So to set the stage, let me just remind you all that today our universe, is known to be full of radiation and matter. Okay, so for example, we have an observed cosmic microwave background, which today has a temperature seen of 2.73 something Kelvin today. And also just a staggering number density of photons. So if we express the ratio of the number density of CMB photons compared to the number density of nucleons or baryons, this ratio is just a staggeringly large number. It's something like, say something like 2 billion roughly. The current present day temperatures and densities of the CMB photons and baryons, like ordinary matter, the present day temperatures and densities are low enough that today, basically most CMB photons don't interact with any matter particles and vice versa. Okay, and so today we can neglect interactions between these different species. But of course, that wasn't always true in the past, And this is because, of course, the universe is expanding. And so in the past, the universe was both hotter and denser. For example, I think that all of you guys, hopefully, in your previous cosmology classes, you've seen, how the momenta of freely propagating particles just redshift as the universe expands, okay? So for example, for these massless photons making up the CMB, the energies of those photons, KE, just scales proportionally to 1 plus redshift, right? And so therefore, at some point in the past, at some high enough redshift, the energies of these, of the photons that today are seen as this 2 Kelvin or 3 Kelvin CMB background, at some point in the past, they were high enough, they were energetic enough to ionize atoms, And so in the past, for example, we can get reactions like, for example, some hydrogen atom can absorb one of these ionizing photons to produce, a positively charged proton and an electron. Okay, things like this were happening in the past. Now, as I mentioned before, the number density of photons is like billions of times larger than the number density of these, of these baryons. And so therefore, at very high redshifts, every single one of these, atoms was just surrounded by this vast sea of ionizing photons, And so therefore, going backwards in time, neutral atoms like this just could not exist, just because so many ionizing photons were around them. So therefore, at some very high redshift, atoms could not exist. There were no atoms. Atoms. And instead, we only had, you know, charged ions and electrons. Or equivalently, going forwards in time from high redshift to low redshift, okay, a phase transition occurred in, okay, you know, in which you know, the baryons transitioned from being an ionized plasma to being a mostly neutral, you know, gas of atoms. And so a low Z, closer to us today, you know, neutral atoms can form. So this transition from this mostly ionized plasma to a gas of mostly neutral atoms, this is called recombination. This name is a misnomer, okay, because actually this phase transition was the very first time when these ions and electrons combined to form a neutral gas. But this being astronomy, just everything has to have like a, you know, stupid name. And so it's called recombination for some reason. Okay, so this time of recombination, this is one of the most important eras in cosmology, not only for, you know, the baryons that were transitioning from being ionized to neutral, but also really important for the CMB photons themselves. And it's worth thinking for a moment about why that is, okay? You know, so question for you guys is, you know, why does it matter for the CMB photons what the baryons are doing, okay? You know, the question is, why does their behavior change once the baryons transition from being a mostly ionized plasma to being a mostly neutral gas? Do you guys have any you know, any guesses for why that matters for the photons?
The interaction of a photon with a charge is more likely than with a neutral atom.
So. Yeah, that's exactly right. Okay, yeah, right. So as he said. Right, so the reason is that charged particles can interact much more efficiently with photons than these neutral atoms can. Okay, so you guys might recall that the you know that an electron can scatter a photon with an interaction cross section given by roughly the Thomson cross section, you know, which is roughly speaking almost independent of energy at the relevant energies here. Right, so this so this is the interaction cross section for electrons to scatter photons. Okay, and this is much, much larger than the cross section for you know, for neutral particles to scatter photons. Okay, especially when the photons have energies below the ionization threshold for those atoms. Okay, right. So therefore, once the universe becomes mostly neutral, okay, most photons stop just pinging, bouncing off of all the charged particles. Instead, just propagate freely in basically straight lines. Okay, so yeah, so therefore, this time of recombination, this is also the time when most CMB photons last scattered. Okay, yeah, and you know, and so ever since recombination, ever since last scattering, most CMB photons have just been basically freely propagating. Okay, good. So therefore, this time of recombination, this is therefore clearly a really important time. And so either today or tomorrow, we'll try to work out in detail exactly how that happened. Okay. But before doing that, I also just briefly wanted to mention another important point in the thermal history of our universe. Okay. Right. So I mentioned up here, right, you know, so the energies of the photons in the past, they're getting just higher and higher, you know, due to the contraction of the universe, you know, in the past. So at some point, the energies of these photons became of order like an MeV or so, a capital MeV, or specifically, at some point, they became of order half an MeV. Okay, right. So at some point. You know, a typical CMB photon has an energy of order, say, half an MeV. And so once energies reach this scale, you know, a process can occur that is not possible at much lower energies. And so you guys have any guesses about what process can start occurring at these sort of energies?
create a pair electron.
Oh, very good. Yeah, very good. That's right. Yeah, exactly. So at these sort of energies, reactions like two photons can scatter off each other to produce a pair of electron and positron. Okay, because both of these have rest masses around half an MeV. Okay, therefore,
initially as time went on, energy is decreasing, right?
Yes.
After this 0.5, coming to 0.5, they should be able to do this, and not after.
That's where I'm going. That's right. Yeah, that's right. I guess I'm still thinking in my observer kind of viewpoint, where we first observe the late universe, and then we move backwards in time to observe the earlier. What's earlier times? But yeah, exactly. You're right. Okay, so we're starting off at very high temperatures. Everything has much high energies. Therefore, there necessarily exists a huge plasma, not only of ions and electrons, but also positrons as well. Okay, and then you then anticipated where I was going next. Okay, which is that. So first, let's just write this out, which is that at high redshift, we have not only ions and electrons, but also positrons as well. But then, as you said, as we go forward in time, okay, the energies of the photons are dropping. So at some point, typical photons have energies below this threshold, okay? And so therefore, this process cannot occur anymore, right? Now, of course, both reactions are happening at the same time, forward and reverse reactions, okay? And so at very early times, both of them are happening, right? And so the plasma tends towards some sort of equilibrium number density of all of these species, electrons, positrons, and photons. And today we will work out what is that density. Okay. So for early times, these sort of reactions just drive themselves towards equilibrium. But then at late times, as you said, eventually the forward process stops occurring. Nothing is stopping the reverse reaction from occurring. Okay. And so therefore, once we get to energies much below this, okay, what'll happen? All of the positrons will just annihilate with the electrons, okay, disappearing, turning into more photons. Okay. Right. So I'll just mention as an aside, one of the puzzles, one of the mysteries right now in cosmology for the past however many decades is to answer why the number density of positrons at these very early times was not exactly equal to the number density of electrons, right? Because if they were exactly equal, they would have all just annihilated, leaving nothing behind. Whereas today, we have lots of electrons everywhere, almost no positrons. What that means is that these two number densities were not exactly equal. There was a small imbalance. And so it's a puzzle even today to understand why there was this imbalance. Okay, the process to produce this imbalance is not understood, but has a name. It's called leptogenesis. And so one of the topics of open research today is this process of leptogenesis. What produced this imbalance? And you guys might discuss that later on with Kendrick, I'm not sure. Okay, good. So at these EV kind of temperatures, we get these, ionization reactions happening. At these MeV temperatures, we can get pair production happening. At similar temperatures or energies around MeV, another important process can occur. Okay, so here I was talking about process involving the electrons, but also at MeV kind of energies, another important process involving the ions can also occur. Which wasn't so important later on. Any guesses as to what other additional processes can become important at sort of MeV energies involving the ions specifically? Well, so by ions, I mean, of course, the nuclei in the atoms, okay? And so any ideas about what sort of reactions might occur? Yeah, nuclear reactions can occur. Yeah, exactly, that's right, okay? So what I mean by this, just simply is that, the typical binding energies per nucleon in typical atoms can be of order just sort of, MeV, mega electron volt. And so therefore, at very high energies and also high densities, nuclear reactions can occur. Okay, so for so examples include reactions like, you know, for example, a proton combining with a neutron to make a deuterium nucleus, along with some photon to carry off the excess binding energy. Okay, these sort of processes can occur at very high energies and densities. Okay. And through enough of these sort of reactions, you can eventually build up large nuclei, things bigger than just hydrogen atoms, or hydrogen nuclei, protons. Okay, so is that process of building up large nuclei, as you said, is called nucleosynthesis. Okay, and for sure, you know, Kendrick or I will discuss in detail this process with you, because this is a really important process in cosmology. Okay, good. So far I've just mentioned, yeah, photons, nuclei, positrons, electrons. There's another species of particle that's also important that also can participate in these sort of nuclear reactions. Any ideas about what that other particle I haven't yet mentioned is?
Neutrinos.
Well, all right, you guys are on point. Right, so we also have neutrinos. Okay, so for example, at very high energies, we can have processes like a proton can combine with an electron to make a neutron, also then electron neutrino. Okay, and of course, you know, reverse reactions can also occur. Yeah, I mean, like beta decay, things like that. So these are called weak interactions. Okay. And in the early universe, because of reactions like this happening all the time, there therefore necessarily must have been a large abundance of neutrinos. Okay, you know, just simply due to all these weak interactions taking place at a high rate back at very early times. Now, you guys may have seen in your standard model class. Okay, you know, so you may have seen that the cross section for these sort of weak interactions depends very strongly on you know, on the relative energy. Okay, so the cross section for these sort of weak interactions scales roughly like what's called the, you know, the Fermi constant squared times energy squared. Okay, you know, where this G Fermi is related to the mass of the W boson. The key point here, though, just is that this depends very strongly on the energy. Okay, and so therefore, at low energies, this cross section becomes small. The rate of these sort of reactions becomes small. Okay. So at small e, okay, this rate becomes small. And so therefore, we'll see that at some point, the neutrinos therefore decouple from the rest of the plasma of positrons, electrons, and nuclei. Okay, so eventually, neutrinos decouple. So this leaves behind a relic abundance of these leftover neutrinos that have to be present, right? And that leftover relic abundance is called the cosmic neutrino background, the CNB. Okay, you know, right? You know, just to distinguish it from the CNB of photons. So the presence of this cosmic neutrino background is a really firm prediction of cosmology. Okay, you know, yeah. So the statement is that there must be a CNB in the same way that there is a CMB of photons. And in recent years, you know, we believe that we have actually detected the presence of this cosmic neutrino background. We haven't seen it directly through these sort of weak interactions, but instead, you know, we have detected it indirectly through its gravitational effects on the rest of the matter in the universe. And you guys might discuss that later on in future classes. Okay, but one point though I just wanted to mention about this cosmic neutrino background, okay, you know, I mean, or actually this process of decoupling, okay, yeah, you know, so this decoupling, this is called weak freeze out. You know, and the time when this happens, again, it happens to be near these sort of MeV energies and temperatures, okay, which is also around the time of this Big Bang nucleosynthesis that we discussed before. And it's also not so far away in time from the time when the electrons and positrons annihilated with each other. Okay, and so later on, probably tomorrow, you know, we'll see that this near coincidence in times between this weak freeze out and the annihilation of the positrons, that imprints important properties on this relic left over neutrino background. Okay, good. So I've just given you this very hand-wavy overview of just a few of the important processes that are taking place, you know, back in the early universe. So recombination, positron annihilation, Big Bang nucleosynthesis, weak freeze out. These are just a few of the important processes that are taking place. There's also many others, for example, like the QCD phase transition, electroweak transition. We won't have time to discuss all of those. And so just today and tomorrow, and perhaps in future classes, you know, the plan is to discuss just, you know, mainly these few processes. Okay?
Yep.
Yeah.
Temperature do we expect for the CNB?
Type of energy.
What temperature we expect?
Oh, what temperature?
Because
good.
And what kind of information can we get from them? Because it's like they released before the CNB, so can we probe the universe with them?
That's exactly right, yeah. Okay, so one of the ultimate dreams, like long after I'm dead, you know. Okay, well, right. So in the CMB, you know, you guys have probably seen these beautiful maps of the CMB anisotropies. Just imagine if we had something like that for the neutrinos, right? As you're saying, it's probing a much earlier time. It's probing these MeV temperatures instead of like, you know, EV kind of temperatures. Yeah. So as I said, at present, we've only detected this gravitationally. Right, so there's no way to detect anisotropies gravitationally. There are planned experiments. So there's this very futuristic experiment called Ptolemy, just trying to, you're trying to directly detect the cosmic neutrino background via its weak interactions. Right. So one could imagine in the future, actually, being able to have, being able to make actual maps on the sky of neutrinos. They won't be as pristine as the CMB of photons, because today, the neutrinos, as we'll see, today they are going non-relativistic, which means that the ones falling into where we are at the bottom of our galaxy's potential well, they've been affected by falling down our potential well. And so there's like distortions that are associated with that. But I don't care. I mean, you know, that'd be amazing, wouldn't it? But so hold that thought. We are going to compute the temperature of the neutrino background. I will try to. Okay, so good. So why don't we get started on this? I'm already going too slow. Okay, so now I'll start doing some actual calculation. Okay, good. So for the thermal history, okay. So the main tool that we're going to use to describe conditions at various times is the distribution function of particles. Okay, so the distribution function is conventionally it's conventionally written as f of x, p, and t, where x is position, p is momentum, t is time. This distribution function, it tells us basically how many particles have locations x and momenta p at time t. Okay, so specifically, this f multiplied by some infinitesimal phase space volume element, okay, is something like, you know, the number of particles of some species. Can I read that? Okay, within d3x of x and d3p of p, of the point x. Hopefully that's legible to you. It's also called the occupation number. To keep this f dimensionless, we will divide this by 2pi a. H bar cubed. Okay. Right. Okay. So therefore, F times this infinitesimal phase space volume element divided by 2 pi H bar cubed. Think of it as like the number of particles within that little infinitesimal phase space volume element. Okay. So from now on, I will be using units Okay, where C equals H bar equals 1. Okay, so therefore, I'll just divide by 2 pi cubed instead of 2 pi H bar cubed, because H bar is 1. Just to make sure that we all understand what that statement means, okay, this says that the units of length are equal to the units of time, are equal to 1 over the units of mass, is equal to 1 over units of energy, 1 over momentum, so on. Okay. Yes, hopefully, yeah, you've all seen these natural units before. Okay, good. So, okay, right. So that's the definition of the distribution function, okay? Right, you know, it's the number of particles within location x, momentum p. So therefore, for example, the number density of particles at some location x, the total number density, okay, that's just the integral of this distribution function over all possible momenta. Okay? So this is equal to integral of f of xp, and I'll just suppress the t for now, okay, over all possible momenta. And the, right. And the convention is to keep the two pi's with the p's. And then also then out front, we have g, the number of internal degrees of freedom of species. Okay, so for example, so for spin half particles, is g is 2. Spin 1 particles, is g is 3, and so on. Okay, so that's the number density at some location x. Okay, similarly, we can work out the energy density at that same location x. Okay, the energy density is a very similar expression. Okay. It's the exact same integral, g integral of f of xp over all momenta. Okay, but now we just weight every single particle by its energy. Where the energy, again, is related to the momentum by, you know, e squared is, that's right, as e is square root of p squared plus m squared. Okay, so that's the energy density. You know, this is a component of the stress energy tensor, and so more generally, we can write out the whole, you know, the whole stress energy tensor the following way: T mu nu at some location x, we can write as, okay, again, just some integral over the distribution function. Okay, so T integral, and then the weighting now it won't be e, it'll be P mu over E of, again, F of XP. I think Google wants to learn as well. Sorry.
I know. But.
I know.
What's that?
Much better spirit.
That's right. Okay, here. So this is the same kind of expression, f of xp, again, integrated over all momenta. Okay, so then, for example, right, you know, so you can see, you know, that therefore, rho is just minus t, 0, 0. Hopefully, I'm using the same the same metric signature that you guys have used, minus plus plus plus. Okay, good. Good. Sorry, what? Okay, right. Okay, good. So this is the energy density. In the Friedman equations, we we need not only the energy density but also the pressure, right? And the pressure is also just simply related to. To the stress tensor, right? So the pressure is just defined as the trace of the spatial part of the stress tensor. Okay, so more precisely, it's 1/3 trace of the spatial part, which I'll write schematically as the ij. Okay, so it's the trace of the spatial part. Let's just write this out. So this is 1/3 of tii, summing over the i's. Okay. And then if we look at our expression, we can see this is g integral. Okay, so now summing over spatial mu and nu, so that's p squared. You have a 3 over 3e of, f of xp, and then integrator over all momenta. Okay, right, okay, good. So therefore, the things that we needed for the Friedman equations, the stress energy tensor, the energy density, the pressure, okay, all these things can be expressed in terms of the underlying distribution function of those particles. So every single species has its own distribution function, right? So for example, there's some distribution function for the electrons, there's a different distribution function for the photons, and so on, right? All of these distribution functions, they all evolve over time, and their evolution is governed by the Boltzmann equation. I'm hoping that you've at least heard these words before in some previous class. Okay, good.
I think if you write down, we'll recognize it.
Okay, good. Yeah. So good. So let's write out the Boltzmann equation in some very compact way. Okay. So for some species I, we can write the Boltzmann equation as Fi t is sum of that's the full Boltzmann equation. This is a very compact way of writing it. It's so compact that it's probably useless to you. So let's unpack this overly compact equation. So first of all, the left-hand side, this is a total derivative, okay? Think of it like a convective derivative. So what that means is that this df dt is a sum over not only the partial derivative of f with respect to time, okay, but also including other terms. So df dx times dx dt. And again, these are vectors, right? You understand that, right?
Yeah.
Okay. df p dt, right? That's the left-hand side. For now, we will initially just think about a homogeneous isotropic universe. Okay, so what that means is that we're going to assume that f does not depend on x. F is only a function of momentum and time. Okay, so that is df dx, we're going to assume vanishes for our homogeneous universe. Okay, so therefore, this term we can neglect. Next, I assume that you guys have already seen that for a homogeneous isotropic expanding universe, momenta redshift in a very simple way, right? So the momentum of some particle just redshifts according to dp dt equals 0, right? This is a statement that momenta redshift, right? Okay, so therefore we can replace this dp dt with that, right? So let's just write this as, okay, so using this makes this term go away. And so this becomes partial f partial t minus h e dot. Actually here, I'll just write out the indices just to make it very clear. Partial f, so okay. So that's the left-hand side of the Boltzmann equation, again, assuming that we are in a homogeneous universe where nothing depends on position. Okay? All right. The right-hand side is a lot more complicated. This is called the collision integral. And just what this means is that this involves an integral over all the possible interactions that can take place that can either produce or remove particles of species I at location x with momentum p at time t. Okay, it's a sum over all the possible interactions that can do that. So of course, the actual expression for this will be quite complicated, depending on the types of interactions that each different species can have. I don't want to get into the details of that here. So for now, I just want you just to think of this heuristically in the following way. Okay. just heuristically think of this collision term as something like, okay, you know, something like an interaction rate, okay, you know, times f, right? So the reason to frame the Boltzmann equation this way, okay, you know, where we just think of it in terms of like some sort of interaction rate on the right-hand side, you know, is that there are going to be two limiting regimes for us to consider about how particles evolve, okay? The two regimes are when interactions are fast or slow, okay? And so we'll use this gamma, you know, basically just to index for us, you know, when these interactions are fast or slow. However, though, when I say fast or slow, you know, I have to define what I mean fast or slow relative to, right? And so we can see by you know from this left-hand side of the Boltzmann equation that the thing that we want to compare this interaction rate to is the Hubble expansion rate. Okay, so what I mean by that, you know, is that in the fast regime, okay, that is when this interaction rate gamma is very large compared to h, then this time derivative of the distribution function is mostly being set by you know by this interaction term, the collision term. Okay. And then conversely, in the slow regime, when the interaction rate is very slow compared to the Hubble expansion rate, then this time derivative of the distribution function is mostly being set by this Hubble expansion term as opposed to the interaction term. Okay. And so it's useful just to work out how things behave in those two limiting regimes. So let's do that next. Okay, so first let's consider the easier slow regime of interactions. Okay, so to start off, let's take the slowest possible rate of interactions. Okay, so for starts, let's just suppose that the interaction term, this collision term, vanishes. Okay, so this is called the collisionless Boltzmann equation because there's no collisions. So if we integrate, on this collisionless Boltzmann equation over all momenta, we get the following. So here, let's just write it out. I can't even see it. But okay, so what we had before was partial f partial t minus h di f di. Now we're setting the right hand side to zero, right? And so now let's take the integral of this. Over all momenta. Okay. Okay, so we have two terms. So let's evaluate these two terms. Okay, so first we have this integral of df dt over all momenta. Any guesses as to what that's going to give?
Number density of f taking the time derivative outside.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. Okay. Do you all follow that? All right. So if we go back to our expression, okay, here what we wrote was very similar to what we have here, except for this time derivative. But we can pull this partial derivative outside of the integral, right? Because he's just a coordinate here for our purposes. Okay, so therefore, this is just d by dt of this integral of f over all momenta, and that's just number density n. All right, so this first term, as you said, is just dn dt. Okay, the second term isn't quite as obvious, but it's still not hard to work out. Okay, so h we can pull out of the integral. Minus h integral over all momenta. I. FDPI. Okay, so now what we'll do, can you guys see this or not? I see that it's actually quite, not very, what's the word? It looks almost transparent, but.
That's fine. Yeah.
Okay. Okay, good. Okay, so to make progress now, what we'll do is to evaluate this integral by parts. Okay? So doing so flips the sign, and then we move the derivative over to the other term. Okay, so we get dn dt plus h integral over all momenta. Okay, now we move the derivative over to the other term, so it's I of f. And what is this?
The number density.
But before that, just this piece here specifically.
Delta II, which is sum of the dimension 3.
3, very good. Okay, so this is 3. And then this, now as you said, is this number density. Okay, so dn dt plus 3hn equals 0, because 0 is still here on the right-hand side. Just to make it extremely clear what this means, okay, we can write this even more compactly as n dots plus 3, and now h is a dot over a, n equals 0. Okay, so what this says in the end is that in the absence of collisions, okay, the number density just evolves like a to the minus 3. Everyone follows that from that step? Okay, and of course that's entirely as expected, right? In the absence of any interactions that can change anything about the particle, of course the number density just evolves like 1 over the volume. Okay, let's do another easy example. Okay, so let's do the same thing, but now let's take the integral over all momenta, but now weighted by energy. Okay, so I just, or is that okay with people, or should I write it out? Okay, here, I'll just write it out. Okay, so now let's weight by energy, now have the same thing. FdT, H, I, okay, again, equals 0. All right, so what's the first term? Sorry?
Stump b squared plus m squared.
Right, but in terms of things that we defined before. So this gave us the number density. So now if we weight by energy, what will we get?
D over dt.
Yeah, exactly. Right, so we'll get, okay, so the first term is just going to give us d rho dt, time derivative of the energy density. And now the second term, we do the exact same thing. Okay, so we get minus h. Integral over all momenta of EIFDPI. Okay, and so now like before, same thing. We'll just now do this integration by parts. Okay, so we again flip the sign, and now we move the derivative over to the other side. So E of this. I times f. Okay, let's evaluate this derivative. Okay, so 0 t plus h integral over all momenta. Okay, dE dp. Oh, is there a question?
No.
You're good? Okay. dE dp is dI over E. dI. Oh, did I? Yeah, no, that's right. Everyone see that? From the definition of E. Okay. And then we get E and then this thing. And before we said that was 3. So plus 3 E. F. Okay. So PI, of course, is just E squared. And now let me pull out this 3. Okay, this 3. I get a 3 out here, 3 down here. And now this is starting to look familiar, maybe. Okay, so we get rho dt plus 3h. Now we have these two terms. This term gives us, the e term gives us
rho.
And the p squared over 3 gives us? I mentioned it very briefly, but you see it up there? Yeah, the pressure. Is glare.
Here's a glare on that important formula.
Just trust me that, yeah, this works out to the pressure. Okay, and then all this equals 0 again in the end. All right, so you guys may have seen this expression before. This is just the continuity equation, right? So you guys probably saw this before when you wrote down, you know, the divergence of the stress energy tensor. Okay, good. So, right, okay, good. So, right, so with the Boltzmann equation, we can recover things that we already knew. One thing I'll say about that is that, you know, from the divergence of the total stress energy tensor, what it tells us is that the total density, you know, obeys this, right? But here, what we've shown is that in the absence of any kind of interactions between species, each species individually also obeys the continuity equation. Which again, I mean, you know, intuitively, I think just should make sense. Okay, good. So right. So this regime of having very slow interactions is pretty straightforward. Okay, so now let's do the more interesting regime of having very fast interactions. Okay, so now we're focusing on fast interactions, which means, again, interaction rate is much, much larger compared to the Hubble rate. Okay, so in this regime, first of all, in the previous regime, we saw that the evolution was just controlled just by the Hubble expansion, right? In this regime, the Hubble expansion will be much less important, okay? Here here what we'll find is that the behavior will be similar to what you've probably already seen before in your classes. Okay, so in particular, when the reaction rate is very fast like this, the distribution functions get driven towards an equilibrium solution. Okay, that makes the right-hand side small. Okay, so what I mean by this is the following. Okay, so first let's just take the ultimate limit. Where let's say the universe is not even expanding, h is 0. Okay, so for a non-expanding universe, I mean, you guys have probably seen before. Okay, so the distribution function gets driven towards some sort of equilibrium configuration. Okay, again, in equilibrium. This distribution function, will have that the collision term vanishes in total, okay? Because again, equilibrium means that f is not evolving, okay? So you might think, okay, what does it mean to have fast interactions but also zero net collision term, right? That might just sound contradictory. But all that means just is that forward and reverse reactions are exactly balancing each other in equilibrium. Okay, so for example, just like schematically, suppose you have some, some process, let's say you have particle A, particle B, interacting in some way with some matrix element to produce particles C and D. Okay. In your previous classes, you've probably seen, that when these sort of interactions happen very quickly, then the distributions of particles A, B, and C, and D get driven towards equilibrium solutions of the following form, where F of P is just given by a thermal distribution. That is, it's given by 1 over e to the E minus mu over T, and then either plus or minus 1. Where the signs plus and minus 1 are for bosons and for fermions. That's familiar or no? Yeah. It's not hard to derive this since I'm actually going way too slow, I think I'll skip the derivation. Okay, so yeah, so just to define the terms again, right? So okay, so E of course is just the energy, okay, of the particle at, you know, at that momentum. Mu is the chemical potential for that species, and T is the temperature of that distribution. Okay, so the statement is that in equilibrium, in this fast regime, okay, you know, these species that are interacting, A, B, C, and D, okay, when these species are in equilibrium, you know, two conditions apply. So first of all, we have kinetic equilibrium, which says that the temperature of A is equal to the temperature of species B, equal to TC, is equal to TD. Okay, this is called kinetic equilibrium between A, B, C, and D. And similarly, we also have chemical equilibrium, which says that the chemical potentials of the reactants, okay, in sum is equal to the chemical potentials of the products, the reactions. Okay, right. So this is called kinetic equilibrium. This is called chemical equilibrium. Right. Okay. So the statement is that, you know, from your previous classes, you've seen how in equilibrium, these interacting species are all driven towards thermal distributions where they all have the same temperature, and their chemical potentials obey this expression. Okay. So that's for when H is exactly zero. Okay. What we care about, you know, isn't when the universe is not expanding, but instead when the universe is expanding, but just at a rate that's much slower than these interaction rates. Okay. So for us, what matters really is the regime where zero is less than H, very small compared to gamma. Okay. So because the universe is continuing to expand, we do not have perfect equilibrium at a constant temperature. Okay. Instead, you know, the solution for the distribution function gets driven towards a near equilibrium solution. Okay. So what that means is that F is not exactly constant in time, but instead it evolves in time. Okay. But the time variation can mostly be captured in terms of a slowly time varying temperature. Okay. So in this regime, what I'm saying is that F is almost a equilibrium solution. Okay. With the key difference that we describe it with a time varying temperature for each species. Okay. And hopefully that makes intuitive sense to you guys. Okay. So those are the two important limiting regimes of fast reactions and slow reactions. So next, let's think about which regime the universe will be in at various different times. Okay. Yeah, let me know when you guys have to go, actually. Oh my God, I went through like a third of what I had planned. Okay. Okay, well, let's just do one quick thing before we quit. Right, okay, yeah. So first, let's just think about which regime the universe is in at various different times. Okay, so first, let's consider the early universe. Okay, so as we said before, you know, back at very early times, densities are very high, temperatures are much higher. Okay, and so therefore, generically, you know, you might expect that we'll be in the fast regime when interaction rates are very fast compared to Hubble in the early universe, right? And then conversely, in the late universe, right, densities dilute, temperatures cool down. So therefore, eventually, for most of the things that we'll, you know, that we'll be looking at, we'll fall into then the other regime where, you know, where the interactions become slow compared to the Hubble rate. Okay? So once the interaction rate is slower than Hubble, then the species that before were in equilibrium will eventually fall out of equilibrium. Right, so once that happens, various things can happen. Okay, you know, so a species can have perhaps different temperatures than the rest of the plasma, you're staying in equilibrium, or even in some cases, the species that fall out of equilibrium it can, yeah, I mean, like, you know, the species can, you know, well, the species can even have non-thermal distributions, as we'll see, I guess tomorrow. Right, okay, so, right, so early universe, we have this regime, late, right, so, low, you know, so late universe, we'll have the other regime. Okay, right, so I wanted first to talk about the, you know, the early universe regime when we're in equilibrium. We only have like a minute left. I guess we could stop here.